You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Today, we are at the Giro d'Italia.
Cozze, citene, cozze, cozze, piscine. Nu spicune și cora. Cozze, citene, cozze, cozze, piscine. Nu spicune și cora, se nu mangiano le femmine.
Where are we, Daniel?
We're in a very famous gelateria in Agrigento. I believe it's very famous. I was told by some Italian colleagues earlier that this isn't, well, the best gelateria in Agrigento, maybe in all of Sicily. And Rich, I don't know if you've noticed, we're standing in front of a vast array of flavours at the moment, but there are about 30 different twists on pistache, which is, Sicily is known for its pistachio nuts, and there are a lot of different types of pistachio. I'm gonna talk to our friend here.
Hey, can I also just point something else out to you? It's like a porridge ice cream here.
Well, there's even more worryingly, there's a pecorino ice cream. Pecorino being cheese that you put on pasta.
There's a Snickers ice cream as well.
Snickers, I'm gonna get some information here.
It's very, very good.
Yeah?
Pecorino.
The pecorino, is that what you recommend?
It's good.
Okay. Best ice cream in Sicily?
Pistachio and pecorino is good.
Thank you.
Facciamo due copette.
Lo cambio, così pure più bello da vedere che quello.
Sì, intanto registriamo una cosa audio, quindi...
Ah, solo audio, eh?
Sì.
Io pensavo da
No. Mi dispiace. Quindi facciamo due copette. Copetta, Rich?
Copetta.
Sì, due gusti, ciascuno. Which flavor would you like, Rich? Oh. It's got to be a pistachio.
It's got to be.
Questo che è base di ricotta, che è una specialità nostra.
Ah, sì.
Pecorino?
Pecorino, yeah.
Is that okay?
Yeah, go for it.
What are you having?
Allora, il secondo, io non, di solito non mangio lo zucchero, quindi ho visto...
Quello è per diabetici, comunque per il corso di
casa. Grazie. Well, Daniel, we've stepped outside with our very generous portions of ice cream. And what an incredible view we've got from the terrace here, looking out over the sea.
Out towards Africa. What did you make of the ice cream, Rich? I mean, as already established, don't really generally eat sweet things at all. And I'm wincing slightly at how sweet it is. But I would say if I was an ice cream connoisseur, I'd probably think this was delicious.
Quite nutty. My one especially. Very nutty. But yeah, very tasty. I'm a big ice cream fan. It won't surprise you to find out.
I see your palette of adjectives and florid descriptions is similar with ice creams as it is with wine.
Nice, tasty, cold. Yeah. Daniel, we're sort of divided today because we're at the Giro d'Italia, obviously, and we'll talk about today's second stage in this podcast, clearly, but our attention was also on Liège-Bastogne-Liège. And what a cracking race it was. Well, both of them were, because this morning, as we were waiting for the start of the stage, at the Giro, I was watching the women's edition, won by Lizzie Deignan, with a solo break from La Redoute. She was chased hard by Grace Brown, but held her off by 9 seconds to win, with Ellen van Dijk third for Trek Segafredo. So they had two riders on the podium. Continues a really brilliant season by Lizzie Deignan. She won at Plouay, La Corse, and now Liège-Bastogne-Liège as well. And then we watched the men's race, which finished about an hour or so after stage two of the Giro d'Italia. And it was a cracker as well.
Well, you did, Rich. I'm going to have to take your word for this. You said it was a rip-snorter. I saw the last 500 metres, which were very entertaining. And we had a sort of a front row seat for some drama, but it wasn't the drama that was occurring in Liège, was it? Not quite.
Are you talking about the Jumbo-Visma bus? We were standing just outside the Jumbo-Visma bus, and... they knew the result apparently before we did, watching it on TV, because there were big celebrations, roars of approval as Primoz Roglic won the race. Controversial finish. I mean, a group of absolute ballers, I think we can say. Tadej Pogacar, the Tour de France winner, Primož Roglič, Julian Alaphilippe, the newly crowned world champion, and Mark Hirschi. They had Mikhail Kwiatkowski with them as well, but he couldn't hang on when Hirschi went on the final climb. Alaphilippe went with him. Pog and Rog were distanced, but they clawed their way back up to Alaphilippe and Hirschi. And there was late drama as well when Matej Mohoric, a third Slovenian, as you pointed out.
Mog? No, we can't really call him
Moha. He bridged across after Matthew van der Poel had been doing quite a lot of work in the chase group. Mohoric bridged across and went over the top, but didn't have quite enough momentum behind him. Didn't get very far. In effect, led it out for Alaphilippe, who sort of opened the sprint, but switched pretty dramatically really cost Hirschi the race, perhaps. I mean, Hirschi might have been the fastest in that group, and he cut him up quite badly, took him out, also ruined Pogacar's chances, and Roglic just kept going. And the guy who we fancied finishing fourth out of four in that group won the race. Alaphilippe celebrated too early. Hubris, perhaps. I mean, he sat up. He was really milking the win before he had the win. And Roglic just snatched it on the line. And I think a lot of neutrals watching that will feel happy for Roglic after, you know, the way that he lost the Tour de France a couple of weeks ago. Oh, I have to describe what happened there. So a football came across the road. And of course, it's everyone's dream for the football to roll towards you and for you to nonchalantly kind of clip it back. Daniel tried to do a bit of keepy up. He failed miserably. The ball rolled.
I balanced it on my instep, and I was going to flick it over my shoulder.
The ball
over my head.
Yeah, but that didn't happen.
It came in your direction 5 minutes ago, and you just hoofed it.
The ball dribbled away from your feet. Someone thought it was your ball and kicked it back to you, so you got a second chance. Anyway, carry on.
Like some big galoot. We were saying about Rog. Kind of typical Roglic in the sense that we talked after the Tour de France about his, well, one of the appealing qualities of Roglic is his sort of stoicism, and even in defeat, and he doesn't get too sort of emotionally triggered by anything, and he just keeps on doing his thing and keeps his head down. And he has done since the Tour de France, that, you know, crushing defeat in the Tour de France, then went to the World Championships, was very good there, and just reward really for his endeavours at the Tour de France. I think, you know, quite a poignant victory.
Alaphilippe had a lot of problems in the race with bike changes. He seemed to get quite frustrated at times. He rode very erratically in the closing kilometres. He was kind of weaving about all over the place, and he rode erratically in the sprint. And then the early celebration, well, is it a bit of cockiness, a bit of arrogance? Will this actually have perhaps done him a favour? I mean, he's not won Liège-Bastogne-Liège before. It's a race he should be able to win, so he's blown a great chance to win it. I'd say he was relegated in the end. I think there's a big question about whether he would have been relegated had he not been beaten on the line. I really don't know the answer to that question, but I think justice was served in the end, and I think Roglic was a very deserving winner, and certainly Jumbo Visma thought so. Clearly there were huge celebrations on the bus, and stepping off the bus it was Richard Pluga, the general manager, the big chief at Jumbo Visma, so we grabbed a quick word with him.
Well, this is good. We're not a Liège-Bastogne-Liège, but do you wish you were there?
Oh, no, I'm here for the team here. But, incredibly happy, of course, with the second monument of the year. It's incredible what we do this season. And, really happy, of course.
Have you had it confirmed yet? Because we've been watching the replay.
Yeah, we just saw the finish photo, and he sprinted, you know. Alaphilippe, you know, divided from his line, I think. So probably he will be relegated, but it doesn't matter because Primož was the fastest on the line. So
I don't think many people would have given him much of a chance in that group, Primož in the sprint.
Well, he is fast, but normally he or she is faster, and Alaphilippe is normally faster, but Alaphilippe was already with his arms in the air. So he had a parachute. So that's where you have to sprint until the line, eh?
And it's not consolation for losing the Tour, but you must be delighted for him after what happened at the end of the Tour.
Of course, but yeah, we look at every race, we want to win, and this was a big chance, and yeah, I'm really happy for him and really happy for the team.
I mean, I almost don't have to ask how Primož has responded to that disappointment, because we've seen him, you know, obviously still very competitive, but how has he been since the Tour?
Oh, you see it there. He's a champion, and he's bouncing back. And yeah, you know, he's someone who can cope with wins, but also with losses. So he can say, yeah, you know, life goes on, and let's focus on the next goal. And that's the way we as a team look at it as well. And yeah, he's an example of that.
You are listening to The Grandest Tour by the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iWalker.co.uk. iWOCA.co.uk.
I'm Ben Granger. I'm 19 years old. I'm a member of Kendal Cycle Club, and I do a lot of road racing. Last year I was sixth in the Welsh National Road Race Championships and 12th at Ryde Hill Grand Prix. Me and my friends started going when we were 16 years old together, and they're really welcoming, even though we were sort of a lot younger than the average member. They go on great rides on great routes around the area, and everyone's just really friendly and welcoming. I'd been after a Strava comp held by James Knox out of Brigstier for quite a while that I took recently, and a kilometre at 11%, which was a pretty hard effort, which is a road we often use on the club rides. James responded on Strava, giving me a bit of credit for the effort, which was quite nice and rewarding for the effort I'd put in.
Thank you very much to iWalker, our title sponsor. We heard there from young Ben Granger, a member of the Kendal Cycle Club, who are also sponsored by iWalker. And as you mentioned, he's been out, this was a few months ago, taking some King of the Mountains belonging to James Knox, the De Koning Quickstep rider, who is one of our diarists, and we'll hear from him a bit later in the episode. He's also from the area, the Lake District area. Thank you to iWalker. If you run a small business and you want to find out more about how they can help you, go to iWalker.co.uk, and we're very grateful to them for their support of us in particular, and cycling more generally. Daniel, I'm pleased to make it up here to our accommodation still with my right arm.
Well, we can hear barking dogs, can't we, Rich? We had a close encounter with an Alsatian, I think it was.
Yeah, I mean, we were driving along. I was a passenger. I had my right arm out the window, and literally a dog jumped at us. And I think it was going for my arm, but it may have got into the car. And what then? How would you respond to that as a driver?
Well, even if it bitten off your arm, we would have carried on. We would have soldiered on and completed.
Don't need your right arm to podcast.
Well, exactly.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I'm grateful to still have it, and we're here in our hacienda for the evening. Don't look at me like that. It's very nice. It's fine. Well, listen, we spoke about Liège Bastogne-Liège. I'm sure there's lots more to talk about that, and we'll probably return to it at some point. It did occur to me watching it that those are the sorts of riders you want to see in the finale of Liège Bastogne-Liège, and we haven't seen many editions in the recent past because the Tour de France favourites have been off at altitude training camps, or it's not been on their agenda, or they've not been in the right shape to contest it.
Talking of the kind of riders who usually contest Liège-Bastogne-Liège, our stage winner today, Diego Ulisi, was asked in his post-race press conference what's the race he would most like to win. He says Liège-Bastogne-Liège.
Well,
right performance, wrong place.
He wasn't going to do it today, was he?
Wrong place.
No, well, as you say, Diego Ulisi was the winner. One of
hotly
the,
tipped by me in yesterday's
no,
podcast.
No, you didn't. I didn't even mention him. He was the one guy you didn't mention. And you said today in the car that you realised that you'd forgotten to mention him. He always gets mentioned, doesn't he, for these types of finishes, and doesn't always deliver.
No, but he's got a good record. How many stage wins is that in the Giro? Oh, neither of us have looked this up. I think probably about four now.
But I remember in 2016 he won down in the southwest, and it was almost the same Valerio Conti did a fantastic job setting him up back then, and he did the same again today. It was a 149-kilometer stage.
Seven stages in the Giro.
Seven, wow.
That is quite remarkable for a
guy. Getting into my tail of the tongue.
Well, for a guy who's not, a sort of thoroughbred climber or a sprinter.
149 kilometers from Alcamo to Agrigento. Thomas De Gendt was up near the front throughout the neutralized zone, so we expected an attack from him. It duly came. and four riders went with him, so a break of five formed. He was the only world, he was one of two World Tour riders there. Ben Gastauer from AG2R La Mondiale was there as well. Mattia Bais from Androni Giacattoli, Alessandro Tonelli and Etienne Van Empel were also there. You spoke, I think, to Gianni Savio, the big boss at Androni at the start, Daniel.
I did. Without further ado, let's hear from the old fox. He's got a new nickname after today's contribution. You're about to find out what it is.
Well, first of all, Gianni, good to see you at the Giro. How have you been in lockdown?
So, finally, we start with the Giro, because we await this with many passion. My English, Daniel, is always very, very bad. So, sorry.
Gianni, it improves every year, but let's get straight down to business. It's a tradition we have now at the Giro, your formation, the Modulo for Androni Sidermec, stage two of the Giro d'Italia.
Yes, for today the Modulo is 6-1-1. So, six riders are the riders that must enter in the breakaway. And one is Jefferson Cepeda, is a young rider, is a climber. I think that he is not able to enter in a breakaway in the flat. But maybe, finish the one is Jonathan Restrepo for the finish. He's a sprinter who is able also in the little mountain, and so today in Agrigento there is a little bit.
Gianni, surely the bomber has to be Ravanelli, no? The famous bomber, Fabrizio Ravanelli, or is it a different Ravanelli?
Yes. I remember Fabrizio Ravanelli because he was as me with
the white feather, white hair.
Yes, white, just when he have 20 years, and me too. But he was a very good player. And also, Simone Ravanelli is, for me, a good rider. I think that he will be able to have to make a good year.
So, Rich, Gianni is no longer il principe, the prince. He's going to now be known as the white feather, like Fabrizio Ravanelli and Simone Ravanelli.
Former Dundee football player, Ravanelli, yeah.
And Simone Ravanelli in the Androni Sidermec team. Gianni, actually, I was asking Gianni about his sponsorship situation for next year. Obviously, it's been a tough time for particularly the Pro Conti teams in some cases, losing sponsors. Androni, after a long, I don't know how many years they've been sponsoring Gianni's team, but they're bowing out, unfortunately. But Gianni says he's in talks with three sponsors who could potentially become the first name, first of 24 names on his team's jersey next year. So good news.
Yeah, that's excellent. That break of five got over 4 minutes lead. It looked like it could be quite dangerous. I mean, obviously we were waiting for De Gendt to go alone. He never did. He got the King of the Mountains points, but he never left his breakaway companions behind. And they were caught eventually. UAE Team Emirates, Ulysses' team, were doing quite a lot with Mikael Bjerg, who was up there in the time trial yesterday doing a lot of work. Bora Hansgrohe as well were helping to keep it pegged back a bit. And it really all came down to that climb up to the finish. And it was an interesting 3.7-kilometre climb, about 4 or 5% most of it. Newly surfaced road, so it was quite fast. And you know, we weren't sure whether one of the sprinters might hang on. Arnaud Démare being a candidate, Peter Sagan another one, if you can call him a sprinter. And Groupama FDJ went to the front at the start, and we
you know, it was obvious what they were trying to do to keep it fast enough to deter attacks, but not too fast to put Damar in trouble. A tricky balance to strike, and Damar did start to struggle, and so his challenge faded away. And it was UAE Team Emirates that really took it on eventually, with Valerio Conti going to the front, injecting real pace, and Ulisi followed. But it was Mikael Honoré, the young Dane on De Koninck Quickstep, who actually put in the first real proper attack and got a bit of a gap, and Ulisi went with him. Those two were clear when Sagan did a very similar attack to Tom Dumoulin at the World Championships, just kind of like me getting lazily off my sofa. He just like ghosted up there. It was very impressive from Sagan.
Very
actually.
Impressive. It reminded me of some of his performances in his first Tour de France, 2012. It looked like vintage Sagan when he just sort of, as you said, kind of lazily lumbered onto the back wheel of whoever was down the road, in this case, Ulisi, and looked as though he was going to pounce. But yeah, he sort of...
I mean, despite the impression, obviously a big effort that I think he paid for, and he did look perfectly positioned, and he made he bridged the gap, just giving himself enough time to have a little rest before the sprint. He seemed to hesitate with the sprint or go the wrong way initially and gave himself quite a long way to go around. I don't know if that made a difference. I mean, Ulisi was pretty fast, pretty lethal in the finish, and a pretty convincing winner. We got a diary dispatch from Cesare Benedetti, Sagan's teammate, said that Sagan was pretty happy. He's in the King of the Mountains jersey. I'm not sure that's really what he was aiming for today, but he's in the King of the Mountains jersey. Best young rider is still Filippo Ganna, who's also in the pink jersey of overall leader. He held on, and I mean, I wouldn't say it was close, but he just behind him there was a split, and the gap to the next rider was 22 seconds, which is his lead over João Almeida. And I said his name wrong consistently last night.
Get out. Did you?
Yeah, I did. Almeida. Sorry, Almeida. We'll hear from his teammate, James Knox, later in the episode. He thinks that he might be able to take the pink jersey tomorrow on Etna, but that's all still to come. So, yeah, I mean, although you didn't mention Ulisi, it was a stage that kind of, as you said, it could have suited the GC rider, Simon Yates, perhaps, or a sprinter, perhaps, but Ulisi is the sort of puncher who it was kind of made for, wasn't it?
Yes, Rich. You know, Agrigento is built on a sort of low hill. A lot of towns in Italy are situated similarly on top of hills. And, you know, for many years, this was a big feature of the Giro, particularly the first week of the Giro, these stages, which would finish after 2-3 kilometre climbs. And there was a generation of riders, most of them disgraced, it has to be said, but there was a generation of riders who really excelled in that exercise of the short, punchy climbs.
Disgracing themselves.
Well, they did as well. And the Rebellins, the Di Lucas, the Ricos, the Bettinis, and so on and so forth. And, you know, they used to be very hotly contested, those stages, but we were looking yesterday, weren't we, for contenders.
Bettini, not disgrace, if the lawyers are listening.
Yes. We were looking for contenders, and there weren't quite so many obvious ones, were there? But Ulisi is a name that really should have stood out. I overlooked him yesterday. But 7 stage wins in the Giro, that is very impressive. And he's a bit of a throwback, in the sense that a lot of Italian riders, particularly in the 80s and 90s, had a reputation for being very strong in Italy and never really exporting their talents and not... showing what they could do on the international stage. And Ulisi is really in that vein. He's reserved his best performances for the Giro. He's won other races abroad, but mainly done his best work in Italy. And is coming, I suppose, into the twilight years of his career. And I suppose that's what he will remain, a rider who excelled in front of home crowds on home roads.
He's just got that great weapon, hasn't he, on these sorts of finishes in his pocket, that ability to finish it off like that.
We haven't had much wine chat so far on this Giro.
No.
I'm going to throw in the first bit of wine chat. You were sort of groaning there internally.
No, no, not at all.
Ulisi is a big wine buff, but I've asked him before to sort of do interviews about wine and talk about wine, and he's always reluctant now because the UAE, of course, his sponsor, are, well, the UAE is a Muslim country, and they don't like to be seen to be advertising or promoting or even really discussing alcohol. But Ulisi is a big wine buff, and his mum works at the Tenuta dell'Ornellaia, which is one of the big estates in Tuscany, one of the most famous estates in Tuscany. There's another wine link that we missed yesterday. The second best Italian yesterday was quite a surprise. I think seventh place on yesterday's time trial was Matteo Sobrero, who's a young climber who we featured in our Giro earlier on in the year. And his family hails from the Lange Hills, where I was on holiday last year. And in fact, Rich, I drove past his front door on three times, I think. And
you mean on holiday last week?
I was last week.
You said last year.
Sorry, last week. And his family make a Dolcetto and, you know, the other wines that that region is famous for. And he also, I think, is the boyfriend of Filippo Ganna's sister.
Wow. And when he saw you at the start today, he said, stop driving past my front door. So 2 days, two Italian stage wins on the Giro so far. I should also say Michael Matthews, another of the fancied riders for today, he was fourth on the stage. Some of the big hitters up there: Vincenzo Nibali was 8th, Peo Bilbao 9th, Geraint Thomas 11th, Jakob Fuglsang 12th. But they had another shocker, Astana, because Alexander Vlasov, after losing Miguel Angel Lopez yesterday, they lost Vlasov today. I mean, the two riders who would have been most help to Fuglsang as this Giro gets into the mountains. And Vlasov, a sort of outsider himself, but with stomach problems. He was ill, he was dropped early. He looked like he was going to be sick on the bike. And the team said he's got some stomach illness.
And this team had already been decimated to a certain extent by, COVID. A couple of the riders were taken out at the last minute, weren't they? Aaron Burra, I think, was one of them. And there were two other riders who should have been in the team and were taken out at the last minute because they'd been in contact with a teammate who tested positive. I was about to say shades of Pog at the Tour when Formolo and Aru were both, bowed out of the race early, but it's even more drastic. It's much worse than that, isn't it? Because we're only on day two, and already Fuglsang has lost his two most experienced and most able mountain domestiques.
They looked, a couple of days ago, you just said they've got the strongest team on paper. And look now. Well, let's hear from our teammate of the stage winner today, Joe Dombrowski, who's keeping an audio diary for us, of course, of UAE Team Emirates.
I think I said yesterday that we had a really good team here to win stages, and I guess I was right. Great victory today from Diego in stage two here at the Giro. I think the team rode really well, executed really well, and it's good to see Diego come away with a win. He's ever since we restarted in August with the season, he's been consistently there, always at the front, and this was a finish that really suited him. And we wanted a bit harder run in into the final climb, hopefully to get rid of, you know, some of the sprinters who can make it over a punchy climb and then have a good finish. And in the end, the only really big name sprinter that was with him was Sagan, and he even got the best of him. So chapeau to him, and hopefully we continue on this trajectory for the rest of the Giro.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you to Science and Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. I know that the cappuccino ride on Zwift today went very well, and I'm sure lots of Science and Sport products were consumed during that. I mentioned it in last night's podcast. If you'd like to sign up for next week's cappuccino ride, I think Lionel is going to do some evening rides on Zwift as well. So pay attention to social media, to your Cycling Podcast newsletter for information about that. If you want 25% off all your Science and Sport products, go to scienceandsport.com and enter the code SISCP25. Something I forgot to mention last night, Stacey Snyder's Giro mugs went on sale on Saturday and sold out immediately. She said they sold out faster than Lionel Burney going downhill. Lionel Burney, as he would have performed in yesterday's downhill time trial. They will benefit the Bahati Foundation in LA and the Black Cyclist Network in the UK. Thank you very much to everybody who managed to get a mug. And sorry if you weren't able to get one, or a cappuccino set, or a beer mug. But she'll be doing more of these, Stacey, for the Vuelta coming up very soon.
C'era ieri alla Crono e c'hanno oggi all'arrivo. Mi dispiace per loro non aver raccolto qualche buon risultato, però ancora il giro è lungo, vediamo di raccogliere qualcosa.
Magari sull'Etna domani?
No, sull'Etna non di sicuro, però più avanti di sicuro ci riproveremo.
Who was that, Daniel?
Well, Rich, that was Filippo Fiorelli, who's one of the local heroes of this Grande Partenza, or Grande Ripartenza, as it's been branded, of the big restart of the Giro. Local hero because he's one of the Sicilians in the peloton. Can you name the others? There are,
Salvatore
I believe
Piccio,
there are four others.
Vincenzo Nibali.
Yes.
Antonio Nibali.
Correct. And there's another by default. Well, we mentioned him last night, Giovanni Visconti, who was born in Turin but grew up in Sicily. But Fiorelli, that was him talking at the finish today. I grabbed a quick word with him. Interesting story. He's from Palermo, so the last few days he has really been on home turf. 26, I think, turned pro at the start of the year, very, very late. And he took up cycling when he was 19. And yeah, quite a nice sort of poignant story. His dad had a bad accident, I think about 10 years ago, and he's in a wheelchair. He can't really leave Sicily, or hasn't been able to leave Sicily for a very long time. So obviously he hasn't been able to see his son compete as a professional cyclist, except this weekend. He's been at the roadside, or he was yesterday, and he was again today. But Filippo was actually a bit frustrated after the finish today, because I think partly is a nod to the fact that he was on home roads. Bardiani made him their sort of leader for today, and the finish didn't pan out quite the way he wanted. But interesting, another ginger Sicilian. Salvatore Puccio is also a gingerhead and from Sicily, and we also went through his hometown, or went past, just past it, didn't we, Menfi today.
Did you find out what happened to Luca Covilli of Bardiani? Because I said in last night's episode that he crashed, was outside the time limit. I don't think he did crash, did he?
He had a puncture, and then he had issues with, I don't know whether it was the replacement wheel, but one of his wheels, and did the descent at a very gentle pace. I think he was a bit unsure on his bike. I don't know whether that was to do with the replacement wheel or not, but consequently was outside the time limit. And off back on his way back to Emilia-Romagna, the centre of Italy Covilli is from.
What a shame. Well, listen, I mentioned earlier that we've got several riders keeping audio diaries for us during this Giro. We'll hear bits of them in these regular episodes and in Kilometre Zero as well. Let's hear now from James Knox, who kept a diary for us at the Vuelta last year, is doing so again at the Giro here. James Knox of De Koenig Quickstep.
That's the first road stage done and dusted. What was actually a pretty easy day into a very mad finale with a big, big, all the teams lined up and fighting for that left turn into the climb. And then, the last climb was just flat out, as I hope you could see on the TV, a lot of guys exploding. I did think it'd be okay for the sprinters, but we just went really, really hard. Obviously, some teams had it, the plan to make it hard for the sprinters, and I think that paid off. I think UAE, one of the big instigators of the day, they were riding on the front, and from where I was riding, the bunch looked like they took it on the climb as well to put people in difficulty, and it paid off. Obviously, from our perspective, very, very impressive ride from Miguel Honoré. Took a very, very impressive third place, so I think we're all pleased with that. Joao also, right up there, finished sixth. He was even in a little bit of difficulty. Halfway up the climb, he had a bit of an incident coming together with another rider, but after a quick remount, well, not remount, he just had to put a foot out, but straight back on the bike, moved up again. In the back of our minds, we thought if it was really hard, then maybe it was a chance. Close to a few seconds on the pink jersey, but from what it seems like, still all the same in that respect. But obviously that's going to change tomorrow on Etna. I think we finished. Well, actually, I'm not sure. We finished in Agrigento and we drove to the hotel. I'm not sure where the hotel is, but we saw a temple. And I know from Googling Sicily that one of the main attractions is the Valle di Temple. We obviously had the presentation at Segesta, where we saw a nice Greek temple. I don't know if that was the main Greek temple we saw there. Anyway, it was pretty nice. nice to get away from Palermo. It was a bit, I don't think we were in the nicest part of Sicily there. We got to see a bit more of the real Sicily. But other than that, from my perspective, just getting into it, to be honest, first day in a Grand Tour is always kind of a bit of a weird one where you're sort of overanalyzing everything, how you're feeling, this and that. And all I can say is, yeah, feeling all right, but certainly felt it today. You know, the first day of any race is always a bit strange. Really, really high heart rate. I think I did a broke many, many records for my heart rate stats for this year. I think I did something like 195 beats per minute for the last 10 minutes, which is, yeah, my little rat heart was pounding. So good to get that out of the way, get a bit of a, you know, proper opener. Hopefully, hoping for good legs tomorrow. We'll just see how it goes. You know, first really, really tough day coming up tomorrow. And all the big GC guys are going to be pretty sure going to be wanting to make a big impression or at least not lose anything. So, yeah, I'll just do my best to follow. And obviously, we've got Joao right up there in a good position to maybe take the pink jersey. So I guess that's our little preview for tomorrow. And I guess that's what we've got in the back of our minds.
So that was James Knox suggesting that Joao Almeida could take the pink jersey on Etna. He is a pretty good climber. He was up there today, actually, I think sixth on the stage. And it's possible. It depends how they race Etna. And it's a new road, a new route they're taking to the top tomorrow, isn't it?
It is, Rich. The race, the Giro, has been, well, it's done some or most of the climb that they're going to do tomorrow. In 2011, and there was a stage that finished on Etna, but the race that day went over Etna twice. The first time up, they climbed from Lingua Glossa, which is where they're going to be climbing from tomorrow. The difference is that tomorrow they're going to be finishing higher than they went that day. And by all accounts, the last 2 kilometres in particular are difficult, and that's where the time gaps are likely to occur. We've had some pretty sterile stages to Etna. There was one a couple of years ago, won by Jan Polansch, which was, there was a headwind that day, there weren't many attacks. But it's an interesting part of the world, isn't it? It's, you know, it's the symbol, really, of Sicily. You see it pretty much from almost everywhere in Sicily on a clear day. I was doing a bit more reading last night, Rich, after I mentioned the fact that the Giro di Sicilia, the Tour of Sicily, predates the Giro d'Italia by 2 years, I found out. So 1907 was the first Giro di Sicilia. One of the big protagonists in that race was Luigi Ganna. And he didn't win the race overall.
No relation,
but he won stages. He won the stage at Agrigento, notably, and he finished second overall. But so that was the Giro di Sicilia. The Giro itself first came to Sicily in 1930, and that was a famous edition of the Giro because Alfredo Binda was paid to stay away because he'd won the previous four Giri, and in the 1929 he'd won, I think, six or seven stages in a row. And before the 1930 Giro, the riders sort of staged some kind of protest, some sort of industrial action. They weren't going to ride if Binda was allowed to ride, and the organisers decided they would pay Binda the same amount that the winner stood to win to stay away. That's happened a couple of times in cycling, hasn't it? Something similar happened with Eddie Merckx in 1973 in the Tour de France.
Did his toe straps have to stay away as well?
His toe straps? Oh.
Well, Binda toe straps, for those of us of a certain vintage.
I actually remember this.
You might be of the clipless pedal generation, Daniel, but he had a real stranglehold on that market, old Binda.
Rich, can we have a live corrections corner? I think I said that Alfredo Binda I said he'd won four consecutive Giri going into the 1930 Giro. He'd only won three.
We did have the last time the race went up Etna was 2 years ago, when Esteban Chavez won.
Yes.
With Simon Yates, his teammate, with him. That, you know, that really set the tone for that race. It established Simon Yates in the driving seat. And I wonder if a similar thing could happen, not necessarily with Simon Yates, but with somebody from that, among that GC group, gaining a bit of an advantage on the others and then trying to maybe build on that in the first part of the race. I don't know. I mean, we expect Ganna to lose the pink jersey, and we expect it, whoever takes it, to be somebody who's obviously able to climb and potentially, if not a favourite, then an outsider to win.
Yeah, I would say so, Rich. And don't forget, we've also got another summit finish coming in a couple of days when we get back to the mainland in Calabria, I think. And yeah, it's going to be an interesting first week. I mean, if you look at the sort of rhythm of this race, when the route was announced, the route as it was announced back a year ago, last October, it looked like a fairly sedate, fairly gentle middle week. That's been rectified slightly because the Hungarian Grande Partenza was erased, and so they added a couple of stages, including a mountain stage in the middle week. But yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what kind of shake-up we get tomorrow. I think, as I said earlier, the consensus is that the action might come quite late. In fact, I know someone who believes that is the mastermind, I suppose, of that Mitchelton double on Etna a couple of years ago, and that's Matt White. And I spoke to him today at the finish, initially about the stage, Simon Yates' performance, and then about Etna tomorrow.
Matt White, two good days, I guess, for Simon Yates at the start of this Giro. Is that your assessment?
Yeah, definitely. It's always, especially in the first week when it's nervous, just staying out of trouble is really important. And yesterday's TT was a nice one. You know, for us, Geraint Thomas is obviously the sets the benchmark for time trialers in the GC battle. And to only lose 26 seconds to him yesterday was a great start for our campaign.
And you also took a fair amount of time on guys like Nibali, but then today we had Astana as well, suffering more misfortune with Vlasov going out. They've lost Superman as well. I mean, you don't want to celebrate other people's misfortune, but that it's in your favour, isn't it?
Oh, it's a big blow for Astana. They've obviously now got, well, there's no debating who the leader is of that team now. But yeah, to lose his best two climbing support, it's a very big blow early on in the race. He's a smart rider, and he'll ride off other teams, but no, we're going to see out of the GC guys who's got legs the first little test tomorrow.
We all remember what you guys did on Etna a couple of years ago. This is a different finish, Matt. You know the course. Tell us about what we'll find tomorrow.
Yeah, look, it's the other side of Etna. I don't know if they've ever used this finish before, but it's. I think compared to the last time we went up Etna, it's a bit easier. The climb in general is easier. It's a lot more regular until you get to the last 2 kilometres, and the last 2 kilometres is pretty brutal, and obviously at altitude as well. Whereas the last time we went up, the climb was a bit longer, had steeper ramps, but also had descents and flatter parts. This one's quite regular the whole way up, but there's a couple of little climbs to soften people up before we get to the bottom. But I don't expect to see too much action until the last 2 kilometres of tomorrow's climb.
So look, mate, that was Matt White. Rich, we had Simon Yates yesterday almost. I thought, I don't know whether he was deliberately making fun of his direct sportive, but did you notice yesterday he started his interview with, oh, look.
Yeah, well, it's very infectious, I think, probably, isn't it? I mean, that his Matt White's voice is probably the voice that he hears
in
the
his
most
head.
Throughout the day.
Yes, yes.
I would imagine.
I can imagine.
Yeah, well, listen, should we wrap it up?
Well, we should.
Anything
we
else?
Should.
Any
well,
other business?
Well, you know, we haven't had too many whimsical asides so far, have we, in tonight's episode? We're missing Napalm. We're missing Lionel to an extent. We're missing his gastronomical asides. Last night, what did you think of the meal last night? I thought it was okay. I wasn't in charge of choosing the restaurant last night. We were in Palermo. We were sitting on quite a nice terrace. A lot of seafood. I'm not really a big seafood man. And a lot of pistachio we're getting on the menu. We had the pistachio ice cream, pistachio nuts. We're actually not really in pistachio territory. So the area around the sort of base of Etna is very famous for pistachio nuts. We'll get there tomorrow. I had spaghettoni, which are big spaghetti with a sort of courgette sauce. But we were talking about Filippo Ganna, weren't we? And we were saying that lo spaghettone, the big spaghetti, wouldn't be a bad nickname for him.
Not a bad nickname at all. I had swordfish. Second night in a row, I tried to have swordfish. I got it. Why do you not like seafood?
Am I allowed not
to
like seafood?
Is there something? I mean, do you like any seafood?
Not really. I don't really identify. I'm not really.
You don't identify with
fish. I grew up in the village in the UK, which is the furthest village from any expanse of sea. It's
that explains it.
It's the geographical centre of England.
What about you like freshwater fish?
No, not really. I'm a mountains man, you know. I'm turf, not surf.
Any rivers or ponds either.
No, not really.
Well, I love seafood. I absolutely love it. And swordfish was pretty nice last night. But I overdid it at lunch. I had a big pizza at lunch, and that left me with not enough of an appetite last night.
You had two croissants. I was aghast yesterday morning. I wondered whether someone was joining us.
Is that excessive? Two croissants for breakfast? That's it. That was it. Two croissants. Is that too much?
And a cappuccino.
Wow. Two cappuccino. Cappuccini. Anyway, well, what are we going to get tonight, Daniel? Because I think we're probably dining on our own here, are we?
Yes, I think we are. I think we'll be getting some kind of bespoke artisanal.
Could be really good.
It could be good. It could be good.
I'm looking forward to it. Hopefully it's lots of seafood. Anyway, until tomorrow, thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you.
Oh, actually, before we go, a few thank yous to friends of the podcast. Big thanks from me to those who have signed up at thecyclingpodcast.com for all the exclusive episodes that you get there. Gary Burns, Malcolm Dines, Matt Hall, Timothy Mason, John Wild, and Michael Kirby Wilson.
And from me to Stephen Wise, Mr. G. Stewart, Mr. E.P. Clark, Stephen Affia, Kristen Wooding, and Morgan Bainham.